It's the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by Zach Duchino. Zach is the administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency. Zach, get to come to your home turf now.
How about that? Every day I get to walk into this office, it's like a brand new day. Still can't believe I have this opportunity. Really glad to have you here with us.
Now, let's talk about just coming to work in Washington, D.C. You're a native of South Dakota. What was it like when you took the position here? What was it a bit of an adjustment?
It's a big change from home. The two-room schoolhouse that I did grade school in on the ranch, one of the rooms was about as big as this office. And there were four grades in it at one point in time. I had the good fortune later in life to have a professional career in farm advocacy and in the nonprofit sector. So I had worked at the Intertribal Ag Council for full-time for 11 years when I got this opportunity. So I'd been used to being on the road, a lot of hotels, a lot of time in the city. So I'd kind of had some adjustment period prior to this. So it wasn't such a huge culture shock. And I've told people all across the country I'd live anywhere on the planet to be able to do this job.
And really, when you think about FSA under USDA, that's almost like a major corporation as it is.
It's a big entity. There are 2,100 plus county offices around the country, 51 state offices, and we've got about 10,000 employees out there. We deliver several dozen programs to over 3 million producers and also have about a $30 billion direct and guaranteed loan portfolio. So it's a really big and meaningful part of the rural ag economy.
Normally, when we think of ag and we think of USDA and Farm Service Agency, it's easy to think about how it affects us back home, whether that's South Dakota or Kansas or Texas, Iowa, even California. But I think sometimes we forget you're also serving places like the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico.
The Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, Hawaii, Indian country, Indian reservations and tribal nations all around the country, even up into the Alaskan Native villages. It's a pretty diverse set of stakeholders that we serve.
And so in many instances, just one approach to solving a problem doesn't necessarily work everywhere. There's a program, though, that works in a lot of places, Conservation Reserve Program, the CRP program.
Yeah, it's one of the largest voluntary conservation programs in the world. And in the 2018 Farm Bill, we were given what we took as a target of 27 million acres to enroll. Right now, we're around 24 million with the 1 million acres that we've enrolled this year that we've accepted offers on, and a record interest in our grassland CRP program again, as well as some really pivotal, game-changing CREP agreements, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. So there's two sign-up periods for our CRP program. The general sign-up, which wrapped up April 27th, I believe maybe April 7th, but earlier in the spring, and then Grassland CRP has a sign-up that closed the end of May. In addition to those two sign-up periods, there are continuous opportunities to enroll in this conservation program, and that's our continuous CRP, which includes the Clear 30 initiative for water and water quality enhancement, the Safe Acres program, which is about wildlife habitat in the states, and then the CREP agreements that we have all across the country. A couple of examples of those I think are really helpful, Tony, to help people understand the breadth of opportunity. We were just over in Colorado for the signing of the Republican River CREP agreement. And in that agreement, we're helping producers enroll in this conservation program as a means to transition away from irrigated practices that they were going to be forced out of anyway because of water compact issues. So it helps them make that transition on their terms, realize a rental income, get some incentive payments to help establish a vegetative stand, and transition into the next iteration of agriculture on their operation. Another example I like to highlight is the work that we're doing in Indian country. We just signed our first CRP contract under the CREP agreement with the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And that opportunity has the potential to bring 1 million acres of grassland into the Conservation Reserve Program in one of those communities that had really, frankly, been marginalized in the past in the USDA's approach to serving producers.
If I remember right, CRP came along when you and I were probably high school, maybe? And so it's been around for a while. And when I look in the mirror, I'm not the same person I was back in the 80s. Have the changes that USDA has made to try to get more of those acres, has that been kind of an update that was needed?
I think so. You know, the CRP program, as you mentioned, started in 85, and we were at home smack in the middle of the farm financial crisis, so conservation measures were really the last thing on our mind. We were just trying to preserve. The changes that we were able to make in 2021 have really helped turn the interest in the program back around. We added some climate smart practice incentives and increased the payment rates in some cases to help producers have a meaningful opportunity to consider that as a viable part of their economic operation. And as you recall, it was created to help remove some of these more environmentally sensitive areas from that form of production, establish a vegetative cover, establish a wildlife habitat. More and more, we're talking about CRP in the context of a working lands program, because I think it's a misconception that conservation and production have to be separate. With our grassland CRP program, it is an effective working lands program where producers are paid an incentive payment to change their grazing practices that will help improve and enhance cover, improve wildlife habitat, improve soil health, which is going to, by definition, increase the productivity of their farm and the gain of their livestock. In the regular CRP, or where we're taking land out of cropping, we use that often in the emergency haying and grazing program to mitigate the impacts of drought or other weather-related disasters to help keep that grazing herd together and more stable. We did some of that in the 2021-2022 seasons and helped preserve those cow herds, and now those producers are going to get near record prices. So it was really a great investment of that resource to help keep that cow herd together, to help producers weather that cycle. We also have a regular haying and grazing opportunity in a lot of our CRP practices. And in that program, producers can stockpile or use that forage, but they do take a 25% reduction in the rental payment that we pay them. But it's a good chance to stockpile some affordable feed that's right there, in many cases, on the place or in the neighborhood.
You did have some producers, though, who really hit some tough times and really wasn't anything that would help them. There was, again, going back to that idea, one program can't hit every producer across the nation in the same way. ERP, is that kind of what's behind that, trying to find and then help those?
Yeah, during 2020-2021, as part of the climate-related weather anomalies that we're seeing, you know, derechos, atmospheric rivers, what do they call the polar vortex, you know, things like that we never heard when we were growing up. We had to find new ways to define the climate reality that we're living in. ERP was a solution that Congress offered us to deliver to producers who had adverse impacts that outstripped their risk mitigation strategies. And in that program, we were able to use information that we had readily available to provide additional assistance to producers, both in the crop side and in the livestock side. Livestock, we had $750 million to help our grazing producers and our other livestock producers, and we already had the information on file. They didn't have to do anything. If they had an LFP payment, we made them a payment. The last thing a producer really needs when they've got a disaster on their mind and they're faced with production challenges is a stack of paperwork to fill out. And we heard loud and clear from our stakeholders, you have this information, why do I got to submit it again? I'm trying to keep things together. So we rolled out the ERP program using existing records. Sometimes that light goes off. We got to move around. I don't know, might have to move over there just a little bit.
I'll run over there.
Oh, there we go. Okay. You just got to lean. All right. So we heard from our stakeholders that we had the information we need to help them. So we used existing records from RMA and producers that had an indemnified loss. We just sent them a little more assistance. Folks in our portfolio that had a loss on in NAP, non-insured disaster assistance program, we helped them with a little more disaster assistance. But there's another set of producers out there who didn't have those risk management strategies available. We made sure that we built a system for them as well, and that's what ERP 2 is. That program closes in July. I think July 14th is the date. And it's a revenue-based approach because we were thinking about how do we catch folks that don't have some other tool and may have a very diversified and unique system of production. Well, everybody's opportunity to stay on the farm is dictated by available revenue. So these are revenue-based approaches, and we really think that we're onto something with this model because folks that take advantage of the revenue-based approach in ERP 2 do commit to a linkage requirement to NAP or risk management strategies if they're available. Now, if we're able to get those more and more of those producers to use those opportunities, that revenue-based model won't be so prevalent, but it'll still be there for those that don't have them.
So much going on with FSA. If we want to keep up with what's happening here, and obviously we just hit the top of the iceberg here, how can we do that?
So on farmers.gov, we're working to improve our information provision to our producers through technology. In just a few clicks, you can find more about any of these programs and the several dozen programs that we have to offer. You're always encouraged to go out to your county office, check with them. They're going to know the most local impacts and the most program availability on a local basis, and they're going to be glad to see you. So get out to your county office. If you want to, you're welcome to call me. Talk to me directly. I've made a point of being available as a public servant, and I'm proud of the fact that my phone number and email are out there, and in most all cases, I get back to people. If I don't, it's not because I don't mean to. I get a lot of email and phone calls, and I want to take them all myself. So don't hesitate to reach back out to me if you don't get me the first time.
Zach, so good to see you. Thanks for hosting us here, and wish you the best.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Tony.
Zach Ducheneau is the administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency in Washington, D.C. I'm Tony St. James. It's the Agribusiness Report.